Welcome, everybody. Happy Thursday. So today, yesterday we kind of busted out of here pretty quickly too, right after we watched that video of Sarah Miles and the meal ministry at St. Gregory of Nyssa. And so I just wanted to pick up, because we busted out so quickly, were there reflections or questions that you had on that as a cap? I was really aware of how many themes from the Bible study were popping up out of the mouths of people on the video clip. Was there anything that you, like, was a curiosity or thought you had on that?
Yeah. It was just interesting to me that, I mean, she could have started a soup kitchen or a food pantry without becoming a religious person. Yeah. Like, plenty of, you know, non-religious people do really great things in the world.
Yeah.
People that need it. So it's interesting to me that she needed that kind of transformation to do that kind of work.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, what do you make of
that? I don't know. I'm really curious about it. Uh-huh.
Anybody have any reflections? I think that's really interesting. She was a lefty, you know, social justice person for much of her life. Yeah.
And she still is in many ways.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I mean, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. She could have been doing, you know, food justice issues.
It would seem like she had kind of a Saul-like conversion, though. It, like, you know, at communion. That was what she attributed it all to. That was her answer to that question.
Yeah.
Was it once she knew Jesus in the breaking of the bread, there was no other way for her? Uh-huh. I'm always jealous of people who have those opportunities.
That's right. Yeah, I think, I mean, what did she say that the requirement for Christianity, for relationship with God through Jesus, was not having the right doctrines, not having the right behavior,
hunger.
But this hunger, right? And a willingness to be fed by something that we don't fully understand. So I it's almost like she had a great experience of being a beggar at the table for the first, in this profound religious way that goes to the deepest levels, and then said, we're all beggars. And then this way of feeding people that becomes this exercise in dignity granted, right? We'll talk more about that today. Anything else? We were just saying, folks who just came in, we ended pretty abruptly after the video clip yesterday. If there's anything, loose ends people wanted to pick up from that.
I didn't see the video, so I'm just going off your question.
Don't let that stop you.
Yeah. But I guess the question I might ask coming out of that is, if she had this profound change that really changed her life for ministry, why don't all of us have that? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes I think we become too comfortable in our, I don't know, living our American life and whatever. When there's a lot of justice issues, and, you know, there's poor everywhere, and you know, we don't seem to, we ignore it.
Yeah. What gets in the way of our own continuing conversion, for those of us who are at that table more often?
I don't know that it necessarily does. I mean, we all can, I think it's a continuous conversion, but I think, like, to her, it just made sense to feed people after being fed. And I think, you know, and you said it's remarkable, you foster children. You don't see it as remarkable, but that's a remarkable act of love and giving that others can't do. So, I mean, I think that sometimes what makes sense to us and we just do because we can is part of the conversion.
We're all different parts of the body.
Well, yes.
And it does seem like some of us have these kind of really powerful religious kind of euphoric things where everything shines. And some people just don't. Some people are these kind of patient people who work behind the scenes and do things that are a different part of the body's work. And some people have, like, the kind of Damascus Road experience. At the same time, I remember Mother Teresa some journalist was asking her why she goes to confession every day, and she just said, because I'm a sinner. And sometimes we can have this idea that boy, people really had this religious epiphany and they've got their whole lives all together. In fact, here's an aside, a story I heard from Fred Niedner, that when Mother Teresa came to, I think it was Valparaiso, and, or no, this was, Fred was telling this story, when she came to Duke University, and she and her kind of personal secretary came to the chapel office, and the secretary said to the chaplain, Mother wants a cigarette. And the chaplain leans and says, excuse me, Mother wants a cigarette. And the chaplain says, did you say the mother wants a cigarette? Yes, and so the first, that's shocking. And then secondly, well, this is a no-smoking building. And mother wants a cigarette. So, in the chaplain's office, the Duke University chapel, Mother Teresa smoked a cigarette, apparently. A different side to what we usually know, yeah. All of us sinners, and some of our captivities as well, all of us. Okay, with that inane example, let's crack open the Bible to Luke 14, yet another meal scene. And today, we're especially looking at the way Jesus serves as a teacher at the table, which, for those of us who read the Bible, that doesn't seem in some ways surprising, but that would be odd today to think about people who would just teach at a table. We think of podiums and PowerPoint and things like that. But Jesus teaches a lot at table. That's, with the classic Roman symposium, that's not that different from that, from Sabbath teaching at the table. That's not that different. But it's striking in the Gospel of Luke how much Jesus teaches at table. So why don't we have somebody read Luke 14, let's go down 1 through, let's just have a read 1 through 6, and then we'll reflect on that.
On one occasion, when Jesus was going to the house of the leader of the Pharisees to eat a meal on the Sabbath, they were watching him closely. Just then, in front of him, there was a man who had dropsy. And Jesus asked the lawyers and Pharisees, is it lawful to cure people on the Sabbath or not? But they were silent. So Jesus took him and healed him and sent him away. Then he said to them, if one of you has a child or an ox that has fallen into a well, will you not immediately pull it out on a Sabbath day? And they could not reply to him.
So what catches your attention in this text or raises a question for you?
Jesus is challenging the law. In a subtle way.
Yeah. Challenging the law, or maybe challenging people's interpretation of it too, right? Is it lawful? By raising some questions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see there's a debate between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. And where the legalistic can miss completely the purpose.
Yeah. So we've got lawyers, even lawyers are here, right?
But they were silent when he asked them a question. Mm-hmm. You know, so they didn't take up the debate.
Yeah, it's because they were trapped.
They knew the answer.
Well, remember here, too, that in Luke's context, we've got the context of the symposium, which is this usually a society of males around a table discussing philosophical questions. And so in Luke's time, people are going to read this as like Jesus is the master teacher, since these people just, they don't even know what to say. They can't respond back to it. It's supposed to be a nice philosophical discussion or debate hosted by this leader of the Pharisees, and there's nothing that can even come out of the mouth of a Pharisee. So yeah, Jesus appears to be here already as a guest again. He becomes the kind of chief teacher at this meeting.
I thought they were on the way to the meal. Do you think they're already there? On one occasion when Jesus was going to the house to eat a meal, they were watching him closely. I've always envisioned this as that they were on the way, not sitting at the table.
It's different than my translation.
Oh,
This one's NIV. It says one Sabbath when Jesus went to eat at the house of the prominent.
Oh.
It's probably about the tense of the verb. Mm. It is, yeah. Verse 7 has us at the meal. So,
Mm-hmm. The dropsy they probably saw outside, not inside.
Could be. It looks like it has the same kind of structure that we've been seeing, right? Which is also a classical structure. The guys at the symposium, and then something happens. That's this diversion. Like, we can talk about this. So remember, it was the woman who comes in crying with the jar of ointment yesterday. And here it appears to be the man with dropsy. Mm-hmm. But what's dropsy?
What says in my translation?
Oh, these footnotes always giving me answers.
Usually swollen in his joints instead of using the word dropsy.
Okay, so swollen in the joints, kind of like water on the knees, water in the joints. It's more dramatic than that, actually.
Yeah,
swollen.
Swollen.
Like full of water.
Yeah, with full of water.
Yeah.
And it's also, it goes with another strange symptom.
Being thirsty. Yeah.
Insatiably thirsty. So you become painfully swollen with water, but you're always painfully thirsty as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so in kind of classic folklore, this was like people saw it as a symbol of being greedy,
mm-hmm.
and kind of in a self-destructive way. And it was often thought of as being brought on by gluttony, that this could cause dropsy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're insatiably greedy,
really,
that you might catch dropsy.
That's terrible.
Isn't it? It's right.
But then it becomes this kind of it works analogically in the story.
Yeah, there's very few accidental things, right? In the text, it's a spare text of dropsy.
You didn't have to
hiccups.
That wasn't it. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Do you want to say anything more about the analogical, or we want to unfold it later?
Well, I think it kind of unfolds. Yeah. If you connect it to.
Yeah.
The following.
Yeah.
Good.
Let me see if there's anything else I want.
The NIV actually uses the words abnormal swelling.
Oh. All right. Huh. Okay. A few things I noticed again. Remember how Jesus was catching flack for going to the house of sinners, tax collectors, and eating with the sinful people. Again, here's that other thing where Luke does this strange thing where he's now eating with Pharisees and lawyers. And so Luke seems to be suggesting they too are sinners in need of a different kind of repentance. If we think of Jesus as a teacher at meals, notice what kind of ironically they're doing. What are they, at the very end of verse 1, what are the leader of the Pharisees doing?
Watching.
They're watching him closely and carefully, just like good students. Except, of course, why are they watching him?
Trying to trap him.
Yeah, they want to trap him, right? And this had happened again on a previous Sabbath over in Luke, previously Luke chapter 6, verse 7, the guy with the withered hand on a Sabbath. They were watching him closely to see if he was going to violate the Sabbath rules.
What do the Sabbath rules exactly say? Do they say you can't work? It's a day of rest? Do they prohibit you from walking down the block to stretch your legs? What are they actually?
Well, you're not supposed to do work, but I mean, then there's all this kind of rabbinical debate about what exactly you're supposed to do. I've heard it interpreted in different ways, that some rabbis would have said, of course you can heal on the Sabbath, and some rabbis would have said, no work at all. Maybe any of you Bible scholars and religion scholars in the room have insight on this?
There's a couple footnotes back to Exodus and Deuteronomy.
Okay.
One of the Exodus passages, and I can't quite see what the context is, but this particular verse in 23:5 says, when you see the donkey of one, actually child is also possibly donkey in the text from Luke, when you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would hold back from setting free, you must help to set it free. Deuteronomy is going to take me a second.
Not sabbatical, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But freeing that.
Yeah, interesting. One interesting example, like just as a modern day Sabbath thing, some of you, if you've been to Israel, you may have seen this on the Sabbath. The avoidance of work can extend to operating machinery of any kind. So elevators have a special Sabbath setting. so that they are just opening and closing at every floor. And you can walk in and just, hey, it just happened to take me to another floor and I didn't operate the machinery.
They have that in Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
It's not an elevator
sound. Yeah. Which I just thought it was a kind of
interesting. They have Sabbath doors, too. Yeah.
Huh.
What's the
blue ones?
We have lights that are programmed so you don't have to turn on a switch or ovens.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So these are all in Deuteronomy. You shall, if you see your neighbor's animal straying or lost or fallen, you shall not ignore it. You shall
okay.
not lift it up.
Yeah. So it's kind of calling to compassion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've heard that some people would say that the tradition, the rabbinical tradition, could certainly justify doing something like this, the compassion of God.
Yeah, I was just going to say one thing that's nice to remember is that the Jewish tradition wouldn't set a hard and fast law that was forever and ever. They would always be debating. So the fact that the Pharisees and Jesus are debating doesn't mean that the Pharisees are legalistic or stiff. It just means that they're still trying to figure things out. I mean, I think the Jewish scriptures are very different than how Christians understand scriptures. If that helps to think about.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Jewish people were still trying to determine what is lawful on Sabbath and probably still debating it.
Yeah, yeah, and it would be good to recognize the kind of classic history of Christian kind of projection of legalism into Judaism, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Because there's this great rabbinical tradition of, like, let's talk about this. Yeah. I've done a lot of research lately on burial practices, and there's a very strong aversion in Judaism to the chemical embalming of a body and letting it go too long. It's considered a religious offense to put these artificial chemicals in people's bodies. And so it's a very strong, kind of predominant wish to do natural burial, unless it would be offensive to the body. And then if somebody needs to be buried far away and the relatives need to wait for the body, fill it up with formaldehyde and get it there, whatever it takes to honor this body as a vessel that God has made. So there can be this strong sense of, let's follow these older traditions, unless, you know, it's important to pull the ox out of the well. Yeah.
Ben, what do you make of the pairing of ox or child?
Yeah,
I don't know. It sounds a little like this Deuteronomy text to me. It's also, those are kind of possessions of the people, and so, of course, children were kind of considered possessions. And here's this outsider. So, and that seems to be the critique that Jesus has picked up with a number of these, that these two are daughters and sons of Abraham, even though they stand outside your circle of ownership. Okay. So let's move on then to verses 7. This is an interesting text because it kind of all happens together, but there are really different things happening. So could somebody take us 7 through 11?
When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come to you and say, "Give this person your seat." Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, "Friend, move up to a better place." Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted.
Yeah.
Like, that's funny.
Say more. What do you mean?
I just, it's a way to, I don't know if that's like serious humiliation or humility. I think that's like strategic humility.
Yeah.
It's a different ball game. It's not really.
Yeah. And Jesus didn't invent this, actually. This was like kind of common. This would be a smart thing to do. It's kind of like a kind of strategy that to save face.
So they all fight for a low chair?
It's interesting what he's going to do with it here. But he's evoking this, right? Yeah. Other things that you noticed about this? What's in this little section from 7 to 11? Is he talking about a symposium Sabbath meal at the Pharisee's house?
A wedding banquet.
Yeah, suddenly there's this image of a wedding banquet. Can we think of other, what does that image get, how does that get evoked in Luke, wedding banquet? It It's like the eschatological feast, the feast at the end of time, the consummation of all things is like a, that, that's the vision of what, when heaven and earth get married, and Jesus himself is the bridegroom. So when the bridegroom is present, not like it was during the times of John the Baptist, a time of fasting, but when Jesus is present, it's time for the feast. And that means that the final days have
and
arrived.
And his bride is the church?
Church, the earth, earth and heaven, you know.
The whole.
Yeah, but this, that's the great wedding that's being taken place, God and God's people. And as we'll see at these wedding banquets, especially Luke wants to emphasize, all are invited. And of course, as we see in some of those texts, the people who received the first invitations, the religious people, say, ah, I've got all these possessions and these things that are keeping me from it. So who ends up getting invited? The poor, the cripple, the lame, which we'll see very shortly here. So wedding banquet gets invited, or gets invoked quite quickly here, and it's hypothetical. So we're not at that wedding banquet. Jesus is speaking hypothetically at this symposium meal. When you have a wedding banquet, speaking to all these guests, you know, this is how you should choose your place, because if you sit low, you may be invited higher. Some of this you can see as a kind of riff that we heard already at the Magnificat, right? So in the Magnificat in Luke 1, we heard Mary singing, God, you'd have brought the powerful down from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. You have filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. It's like from just the previous chapter, Jesus ends one of his sayings with saying, indeed, some who are last will be first, and some who are first will be last. So again, another one of Luke's invocations of how when we encounter Jesus, we should get ready for the reversal of our social expectations, the way things are structured here. One of the things that I've kind of liked about this, in this verses 10 and 11 about where to sit at a banquet, one of the ways I've thought of it, you can use your butt as an instrument of the reign of God. We don't have much, you know, kind of a piety of our butts, but where we plant these things, where do we sit relative to other people? And some commentators have said that what Jesus is pointing out here is that these people who are craving these first seats, the place of honor, are exhibiting what people in Luke's time would have seen as a kind of a moral form of dropsy. They're just craving these first places. And Jesus is saying, reject it and sit lower. And then, in this kind of mysterious way, you may be invited up higher. Yeah.
But it's weird that then the goal is still to be invited higher. Like, you can't, like, being low is still not going to be satisfying, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's the conventional way that often gets used. And I think, that would be an unfortunate way, I think, according to everything that we see in Luke, for people to interpret it, right? But it's ripe for that. You could interpret it that way. You can be calculating, if I sit low, then I'm going to get invited higher. But I think overall what Jesus is saying, and it, we'll see it, I think, in this next section too, is that that kind of calculating is to be no more. Okay. So now notice what happens. Jesus was kind of speaking hypothetically to this group. You all, when you all invited to a wedding banquet, here's how you can sit. Now look, he turns to the host of this meal, talking about, as apparently, a critique of this very banquet. So how about somebody taking us 12 through 14?
He said also to the one who had invited him, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, in case they might invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous.
All right, so what just happened there? What's going on? He's talking to this host, and what's he said?
Invite all the outcasts.
Yeah, and invite all the outcasts, and don't do what?
Invite your friends and your family, and which is probably exactly what he had sitting at the table.
Yeah, yeah. And a specific, what would be the hopes of inviting those people? Why would you do that?
Because they'd remake you back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Social commentators on the scriptures say that the central social rule of Greco-Roman society at this point is reciprocity. Mm-hmm. So that I give to you, and you will give back to me. And this is a kind of a calculating way, kind of keeps society in order, but it can be burdensome. And of course, if you've got more to give, you're going to be getting more. It's, it keeps the resources flowing in the places of the
status quo
of the 1%, right? Yeah. This reminds me of a professor of mine who works in India sometimes, and said there's a culture of reciprocity there around. The, when you go and are the guest of someone, you give them a sari. And she said there's a feminist movement to start abolishing it because it becomes so oppressively expensive that you're always giving these new sari. And she says she's got these stacks of all these that she's received. And it just becomes really burdensome.
I don't suppose you can recycle them.
Yeah, I think there's probably some taboo against that, right? Yeah. But you can see, Jesus is saying, let's reject that. And probably today we can see that kind of social reciprocity. I'm going to invite these people to my party because they'll reflect highly on me, or I'll be able to get something out of that later. And Jesus seems to be completely rejecting that. Invite the poor, the lame, and the blind.
You know, that actually strikes a chord with me, the people that repay. Think about how our whole political assembly is run. Lobbyists, they are paid to attend the parties and to be reciprocal. That is how the laws in the country get changed, by the rich and powerful, and they are the only ones at the table. It's really hard to get a voice at those tables.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Yeah.
For social justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes you'll even hear a politician kind of despairingly admitting that, you know, the voices of the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind don't often reach those settings.
And think about, you know, the whole notion of pork on all the bills. I mean, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
If you give me mine, I'll give you yours, yeah. and it's a kind of a good old boy thing. And there is no room at the table for anybody else. If you don't have something to offer or trade, you can't get a seat.
Yeah. Remember, we looked at the text of Jesus at the Nazareth synagogue. And remember in that section when he's dealing with the word in Isaiah, remember what he says, the scripture that he is fulfilling, what it's doing. Let me just read this. So Jesus unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. God has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor," which is a reference to Jubilee year when the debts are forgiven. So Jesus, in some ways, is invoking some of that same imagery and saying, you now bring on Jubilee at your own feasting, at your own gatherings. I can hear a little bit here, this echo of Luke's wrestling with the question, where do we see the risen Jesus? And here it seems to be, at your own feasts, depending on the people that you invite. If you want to see this eschatological wedding banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. You will see the risen Jesus. What did I want to say? Oh, and here's that thing about repayment. We get that an image of repayment. You will be repaid at when?
The
resurrection of the righteous. So some of the commentators here say, this is so, like, the way we hear this is kind of like religious, oh, when I get to go to heaven, then I'm going to get this, that what this does is it takes it actually out of the economic equation. Like, if you think that you're going to be repaid for that kind of meal, you're going to be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous, whatever that means, right? It takes it outside of history, outside of our economy, and makes it, the way you operate then will be fully by faith. You're not going to be doing this in hopes of any kind of comprehensible reward. You'll be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. What is that? Money? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know, whatever that is. Yeah.
I find this, what this has to say about kind of social relations and how we, you know, we sort of construct our sense of our kind of self and our worth often by those whom we can count our associates, those whom we kind of burnish who we are, right? By our social value we can kind of accrue around us. And we all do it.
How many Facebook friends do you have, Scott?
Right.
And who are they?
Yeah. And so suddenly Jesus is saying, have this party at which will not only do nothing for your reputation, but it'll be an utter loss of reputation for you. It will accrue no social value for you. And so kind of really just clearing the slate in terms of how we kind of construct value, how we construct our identities.
Yeah. Have people struggled with this? I think this is much more than about individual social decisions, but at the same time, it's about those individual social decisions. Do you struggle with this about who to sit with at the employee lunchroom or to have over for dinner?
Or in the dining hall.
Or in the dining hall, yeah. I know on the train on the way here, I was conscious there was a guy traveling from Chicago who had a knit cap on that was literally worn out at the top, and he was grouchy and pissy, and he was on crutches, and his pants were falling off half the time, and he had he apparently had diabetes because his foot was just gnarly, and he insisted on putting it up in the dining car because his doctor told him to. And people were avoiding him like the plague, except for these amazing kids who kind of came in, teenagers, and clearly were just like, who is this man? And showing him such kind of honor and wonder about what his life story must be. And I was thinking, wow, there's a lot of people pulling back, but this looks like some kind of gospel movement here as people are around this guy, breaking bread with him in the Buick car, and his kind of amazing foot. I don't know. And again, that's on a personal level. That's not cosmic, but maybe that's where we begin to see the cosmic breaking in. I don't know. Other people have had stories or experiences.
Well, I mean, it'd be interesting if you're in that situation. Maybe he says, don't invite your friends and family. What if you're taking the train with somebody really important to you? And you're like, well, I'm not going to sit next to you. I'm going to sit next to this, crazy guy. Or this person who, what are you bringing to that relationship? That's kind of trivial, but.
Yeah, so to think about.
If you didn't invite any of your friends and family to your Thanksgiving.
Bonnie, you had that example yesterday of taking your friends and family to a Thanksgiving dinner, right?
Yeah.
Where you were
serving
the poor.
Well, it was from Penny, yeah.
Oh, Penny, Bonnie, yes, go ahead.
That's fine. All good.
Great.
There's another mine, too. No, that was just an opportunity. We had done some foster care stuff, and so there was an opportunity to serve. And it was just I don't know, I get kind of burned out sometimes about having my family, just my family around. I don't always see eye to eye with everybody. So, I mean, they're good people, but just, the whole, my brother, that's a long story. I'm not gonna go there. No. So I like to look for the reason for the season and that kind of stuff, and when I'm searching for that, I'm not going to find it at the table with my family. So I find that if I invite people from outside, I like to do that. I like to do that at holidays. I like to invite people into church that I know are single, or just don't have a place to go. If you find somebody who's not going to, and I'm always hey, I've always got an extra seat. That is way more rewarding, and that's not about this. It's just about me.
Our second child was born seemingly normal, but as the months and years went by, it became obvious to us that he was quite developmentally disabled and delayed, and that turned into be a lifelong thing for him. He's 35 now, but we then grew with him into the land of people with disabilities,
yes.
And so it's really. Interesting to see how that changed our comfort level with people with disabilities and how we can observe the uncomfortableness of, how you don't know how to talk to somebody. So people tend to kind of stand off. And some of it is just not because, just not being comfortable. And so the real gift that Levin has given us is that he just kind of cracked that open.
Yes.
It's pretty easy to talk for me to talk to people with varying levels of abilities.
Yeah.
And
thanks to this son of yours, you have a wider social, what, social
comfort
circle
zone.
Yeah, and comfort zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your table's been expanded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think part of what Luke's point is, too, here is for, in the end, all of us are going to come to recognize ourselves as beggars, as people in need, so that together with our family, we're also all there as beggars. And so many people in this place have taught me these practices of always being ready to, if there's somebody on the street, there's always going to be, we can spread another place at the table, and what that's like. We were just beneficiaries of that when Justin and I went out and many of you know Pastor Paul Palumbo down there and just said, get your butt in here, you know, walking home from the hospital. And they just set another place, two more places at the table. And we felt it was, it's significant sharing meals in those needy places.
Can I ask a question? It seems like in the Old Testament, you have, I mean, like the scroll that Jesus reads from in Isaiah and the Psalms, it's not as if the poor and oppressed are outside of the Old Testament. I mean, it's there, you know. I mean, he's reading, talking about good news to the poor. And so I guess my question is, this seems like it's present, and Jesus is there reinterpreting or speaking about it. But I guess I don't understand the sense in which the Israel, the community of Jewish believers at that time would have understood these references to the poor and oppressed outside of, I mean, how did they see it and how are we looking at it? I think I'm
not sure. Are you saying would they have heard Jesus' message as discontinuous or?
Yeah, or I mean, would they have heard references in what we call the Old Testament as like to the poor as maybe themselves, like the poor in spirit or the poor and oppressed? Or how would they have recognize that poverty, because this seems like it's sort of revolutionary, but it's there. I mean, he's quoting scripture to give it back to them. So,
well, I mean, a few things. First of all, most of Jesus' early followers are Jewish people, right? So even though we get these interactions with, like, especially in the Gospel of John, it sounds like the Jews are the people who are against him, but it's never quite that clear. And in fact, you know, again, most of his faithful followers are Jewish people. And then there's this layer that this gospel is written for a Christian community. And these struggles seem to be in the past, especially in Luke, but they're probably also about current struggles, about who's in and who's out. So we're also reading that layer. But my sense is that many Jewish people of Jesus' day would have seen him in radical continuity with the prophetic tradition. You know, he's speaking as a prophet. He's also speaking in ways, at least in the Gospels, that do things that probably other human beings would not be doing, declaring directly forgiveness. If you've done something wrong to this person and Jesus speaks forgiveness, that's going to be pretty radical. And calling himself here the Lord of the Sabbath, to turn that Sabbath again so fully to the needs of God's people. I wonder, let me sum up a few things here that I see going on. Hearers of this text, we would say, would probably be hearing strongly that they should avoid the preoccupation of kind of acquiring wealth and status in society. And that quest, I mean, if we think about what we might call today the American dream in our context, hearers of Luke are going to hear that actually is set against the will of God. It's against the will of God to seek the American dream of being, you know, socially above other people, like, and being above those who are poor. When we hear this, that actually in social situations you're not supposed to seek the highest place, but to seek a low place, right? From the low. And then it completely upends this idea of social reciprocity, which again was at the kind of the heart of Greco-Roman society. So that instead of seeking to curry favor with the rich and the powerful, actually reject that and go for the people who you know can't repay you. So that's kind of a revolutionary way about it. And again, following up on Luke's business with Emmaus, this solidarity with the poor is one way the church sees the messianic banquet happening, one way we see the risen Christ among us. So why don't we take a second here and actually sing a hymn that kind of reflects this, drawing on some Emmaus imagery. Bonnie, are you up for it?
Sure.
Do it? Awesome. Not Penny, but Bonnie.
You don't want me to play the piano.
This is hymn 725.
Unless you like chopsticks.
And some of you in the back who are not knitting.
Oh, you even have
to. Oh, I love this.
Yeah, 725. Do you want to play the melody once so people want to know? This community for the most powerful thing in the cosmos, for the force that what spun out the galaxies and made each one of us. Luke says you find it hidden among the poor, a banquet that is not going to be repaid by the rich and the wealthy. In fact, that many of the powerful don't want to have anything to do with. Jesus invites those folks into it and invites us into spreading it, and then even invites those like the Pharisees and the rich to be part of it. They become also beggars in need of this feast. I want to highlight two more quick texts before we go. We won't have time to go through them, but just I think it's an interesting set of contrasts about the way we think of ourselves as servants at the table of Christ. So the first one is Luke 12, 35 through 38. And I'm just going to read this fairly quickly. Be dressed for action and have your lamps lit. Be like those who are waiting for their master to return from the wedding banquet, so that they may open the door for the master as soon as he comes and knocks. Blessed are those slaves whom the master finds alert when he comes, right? We're thinking we're the slaves. Truly I tell you, Luke doesn't say this very much, so pay attention. Truly I tell you, that master will fasten his belt and have them sit down to eat, and the master will come and serve them. If the master comes during the middle of the night or near dawn and finds them so, blessed are those slaves. So we'd expect the slaves to be serving the master, of course. But here Jesus says, these slaves waiting for the master, related to this cosmic wedding feast, they're the ones who get to sit down and be served by the master. Right? So then let's hold that text together with one more. Luke 17, 7 through 10. Who among you would say to your slave who has just come in from the plowing or tending sheep in the field, come here at once and take your place at the table? Would you not rather say to the slave, prepare supper for me, put on your apron, serve me while I eat and drink, and later you may eat and drink? Do you thank the slave for doing what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that you were ordered to do, say, we are only worthless slaves. We have done only what we ought to have done. Worthless there, actually, I would translate it unnecessary. We're unneeded. So these two texts, which seem to like completely contradict each other in some ways, are, I think, beautiful ways of holding together this tension. Those who are attentive, hopeful servants of God waiting for this eschatological banquet will actually be the ones who get served by Christ, who washes our feet, who comes to serve us when we ourselves are beggars. And yet, as a kind of critique of any of us who would find ourselves, well, I'm a religious leader, there's this also this word, we're only unnecessary servants. We're only doing what we should have done. When I take my kids to the Thanksgiving dinner to serve the hungry and the homeless, that's just what I should have done. That's unnecessary, right? So those two images, I think, are fantastic ways of teaching what true leadership is. And we see it at the table. Jesus teaches this at the table, coming to know who God is and who we're called to be as table servers. So, thoughts, questions? Yeah?
When the Bible refers to slavery like this, was it like it was, you know, in the early 1800s in the South, where people would be bought and sold, whipped?
Good question. Are you thinking you want to supply your own answer, or is it an innocent question? Oh, yeah, so different than chattel slavery. Still, you know, coming in, probably hope, for some Christian critique of slaves in Christian assemblies, slaves and masters seem to have a good deal more equality, that at least in the Christian assembly, that would be different. But the social institution of slavery was really nothing like the kind of chattel slavery that we have here. It was more like indentured servitude.
So when they used the Bible to justify it, they
cheated. Right. Of course, there are things that you could use. You can use the Bible to justify many different things. But of course, the central motif, one of the central motifs, is the God frees slaves. You know, sets the oppressed free. Well, again, we're at quarter till, or actually 10 till now. So I'll let folks go if you'd like to go. And if you want to have more conversation, I'll be here too. But thanks again for a wonderful afternoon discussion. And I'll see you at the table upstairs.
Thank you. A wonderful resource for stories about hospitality that sort of turns things on its head is the 19th Central Committee put out a book called